Go ahead and turn to Exodus chapter 16 this morning. And as you make your way there, let me just talk about the least favorite part of Lori and I's recent vacation journey. It would be cruel of me to talk about the highlights and different things like that. Some of you haven't experienced 80-degree weather in a while. Some of you haven't had a vacation in a while and you really need a vacation. So instead of talking about the highlights, I'm going to talk about one of the lowlights of our trip. And it is this. It is the airport. I think it's probably safe to say that for most people, the airport is the least enjoyable part of their trip when they fly from place to place. And on our trip from Fort Lauderdale to Midway and on our way back, we saw hundreds upon hundreds and hundreds of people making their way through the airport. They've either come back from somewhere or they're on their way heading somewhere. Now, already knowing that I would be talking about my airport experience in this message, I kept my eyes and ears open for what was going on around me. And not long after the picture you see, and you can tell, I am thrilled, absolutely thrilled to be sitting on the floor in the airport. Not long after that, I was, like I said, watching. There was a little argument that was happening. There was an airport staff person that was having a conversation with, seemed like a lady and her mom, and they were not happy about something. I think they were wanting to check in, but they weren't going to be allowed to, and this person kept explaining what the problem was, and let's just say that I was very impressed with the airport staff dealing with this nonstop thing that was going on. Lots of things like that, like I said, just with the check-in process. While there may be some people who are newer to flying, they're fascinated with watching the planes and fascinated with this almost like a city unto itself, a world. It's just very different from everything else. Most people are not thrilled to be at the airport or thrilled with the airport itself. I recently saw most people I saw seem to be anything but happy. What I did see were people who are visibly, tangibly anxious. People worried about making their connecting flight. People worried about their flight being late or getting canceled. Fortunately, we had nicer weather, so that wasn't as much of a concern. People worried about boarding at the very end and not being able to sit with who they came with. That was one of the concerns that Lori and I had, was if we boarded really late, well, are we going to be sitting at different spots in the plane? For me, I hate the waiting process. You go through a variety of things, taking off your shoes and belts and everything else just to be able to get to the other side where you can be able to wait to board, and then you just sit there and wait. It feels like a trap because everything is so high priced. It's like, what is the inflation rate here at the airport? Everything costs so much. Since our departing flight, leaving on the way out, was leaving early in the morning, Laura and I were kind of lucky. We didn't have to worry about lines. We got there a little bit later. My friend, my chauffeur, helped us get there. And we basically got through, and we were able to wait just a little bit and get going. But before we got on the plane, we needed to have something for breakfast. We had hurried to get there. So we had an $11 breakfast sandwich that Laura and I ended up sharing, and a $4.52 drink to go with it. It was a $15 breakfast that, like I said, we had to split in half. The trip back was an altogether different situation. We got to the airport about 11 o'clock in the morning, but our flight didn't leave until almost 5 o'clock that evening. 5 hours of waiting. And for the first 2 hours that we were there, we couldn't even check in our luggage, which is why you see me sitting there. Now, you could have paid money to the people on the curb. They would have taken the luggage earlier, but I was done giving the airport money. I already spent $15 on a breakfast earlier. I'm not giving them any more of my money. So still grumbling about the $15 I had spent on all that stuff, I wasn't going to give them any more, and so we sat with our bags, and we weren't alone. When we got there, we had to find this little space where we could sit because there were so many people that were there early. They were probably coming back from cruise ships too, and so they're sitting at the airport just waiting with their bags. There are so many people there, like I said, we had to find, and the place where you can kind of see a wheelchair on the back side of the luggage. So this was a little area where they needed to get these chairs in and out every once in a while. So every time they needed to bring a chair back or take a chair out, we had to get moved around and out of the way so they could access what they needed. On the way out, so it was a miserable 2 hours just for us sitting and waiting there before we were waiting somewhere else. On the way out, we couldn't just wait to get beyond the airport and get to the land of warmer weather. A paradise where we could enjoy the beach, clear blue ocean, a paradise where there was this boat filled with food and filled with fun things to do. We had been watching hours upon hours of videos about the ship we were going to be getting on and about this cruise itinerary, so we were very excited. We weren't excited about the airport. We wanted what was on the other side of the airport. We had been counting down the days for us to finally be there for a good part of a year, it felt surreal for us to cross the threshold from waiting to actually being there and seeing the ship. Seeing the ship was as our shuttle was making his way into the port area was a huge relief. We'd made it through all of those hurdles that a certain someone had been very anxious about all along the way, and we could finally breathe a sigh of relief. On the way back, we just couldn't wait to be back home. Even though the Chicagoland area in early March is the furthest thing from a paradise, there is a comfort that comes with familiarity. This is what we know. This is what we're used to. And so we're ready to be back home, even if it was cold and even if it was a little dreary. In comparison to the airport experience, this place looked like a heavenly alternative. And with that, let's read from Exodus chapter 16. So go ahead and stand as I read. It's Exodus chapter 16. I'm going to read verses 1 through 16, and then I'm going to skip to verses 31 to 35. This comes just a little bit before the passage that Larry read earlier from Exodus 17. So Exodus 16, beginning in verse 1. The whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots and meats and pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted." Sounded like kind of cruise, like, oh, it's wonderful. All the food you could imagine was back in Egypt. Back to it. But you have brought us out of this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. Then the Lord said to Moses, "I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way, I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. On the sixth day, they are to prepare what they bring in, and that is to be twice as much as they gather on the other days." So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, "In the evening, you will know that it was the Lord who brought you out of Egypt. And in the morning, you will see the glory of the Lord because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we that you should grumble against us?" Moses also said, "You will know that it was the Lord when he gives you meat to eat in the evening and all the bread you want in the morning, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we? You are not grumbling against us, but against the Lord." Then Moses told Aaron, "Say to the entire Israelite community, 'Come before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling.'" While Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked toward the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. The Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God." That evening, quail came and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, "It is the bread the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Each one is to gather as much as he needs. Take an omer for each person you have in your tent." And then skip to verse 31. The people of Israel called the bread manna. It was white like coriander seed and tasted like wafers made with honey. Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Take an omer of manna and keep it for the generations to come, so that they can see the bread I gave you to eat in the desert when I brought you out of Egypt." So Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar and put an omer of manna in it, then place it before the Lord to be kept for generations to come." As the Lord commanded Moses, Aaron put the manna in front of the testimony that it might be kept. The Israelites ate manna 40 years until they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. Go ahead and be seated. The departure of the people of Israel as they set out from Elim, which is where Elim gets its name, following their release from Egyptian captivity and crossing the Red Sea, was an entry into what was effectively a 40-year experience in the airport. A 40-year state of existence where they were not able to go back to the land of familiar, and they were not able to enter into a promised land future. It was an awkward and anxious period of time in a place where nobody, absolutely nobody, wanted to be. 40 years of Israel basically living out of their suitcases as they found themselves moving continually. Wherever the cloud moved, they had to move. And so they had to be ready to pack up everything that they had, pack up everything to do with the tabernacle, and move. So there was almost like they were moving and camping, you know, like an airport, but camping, even worse. I'm not a fan of camping. I'm not a fan of airports. And they ended up with this trip winding around and around, but never actually arriving anywhere new. Just more of the same old wilderness and the same old manna for 40 years, day after day. There are some bad things that can happen in a desert experience. There are some bad things that can happen when people find themselves in a place and in a situation for a season where they just do not want to be, especially if they find themselves in a place where they don't want to be for a long time. When it comes to the Israelite community in Exodus, one of the bad things that can happen in the wilderness gets started early on and it becomes visible in their grumbling. A glorified version of the past. In the wilderness, there is a temptation to tell glorified versions of the past. When the grumbling gets going inside of the community of Israel, one of the things fueling their grumbling is their memory of the past. Like I said, they were describing Egypt like it was a cruise ship filled with food. Just amazing place to be. They look at their current surroundings in the wilderness, and they look at what they have to eat, and they begin to reflect on their former lives in Egypt. They start to share with others stories about the good old days. The problem with what they were doing is the fact that their memory is extremely flimsy and false. If you go back to the very beginning of the book of Exodus, what you are going to find are miserable living conditions. Slave masters who were put over the Israelites and oppressed them with forced labor. Orders were given out by Egyptian leaders to the midwives to kill the baby boys of the Israelites. Egyptian leaders did that. Then later on down the road, when God speaks to Moses from the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3, it's there that we learn that God has seen the misery of his people in Egypt. He has heard them crying out because of their slave masters, and he is concerned about their suffering. It is at this point where God promises to deliver them from that misery and from that suffering, from all of that mess, and bring them into what we call the promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey. If you read straight through from Exodus chapter 1 to the passage we just read in Exodus chapter 16, you should be scratching your head about the grumbling the Israelites are doing, where they're talking about Egypt in the way that they are. What kind of a glory day past are they talking about? And the answer to that question is they are talking about a glorified past. The grumbling Israelites are talking about a past where they have some sort of a selective amnesia going on, where it's like they remember some of the highlights or remember certain things, but they're forgetting much of what happened, forgetting the labor, forgetting the killing, forgetting the abuse. When the ugly parts of the past get erased, what you are left with is a distorted version of events, a distorted version of the past, making it look much better and more appealing than it actually factually was. The people of Israel start telling and start believing a false narrative of the past, and it resulted in a grumbling and a discontentment about their present. This is the sort of thing that a community like the church has to be mindful of when it comes to the kind of storytelling the church can engage in regarding its own past. If we're not careful, we can get caught up talking about the church past in ways that aren't true because they aren't necessarily the full picture. We can be tempted to look at our narrow slice of church history through the lens that filters out the bad so that we only see the good. If you compare the worst of our present with an embellished past, the past is always going to win as far as where we would rather be. The past is always going to be where you would rather be instead of being where you are right now. Instead of being precisely where God has brought us. God powerfully and miraculously brought his people out of misery and across the Red Sea and into a wilderness. They were where God wanted them to be in that moment. They were exactly where God wanted them to be, but they had difficulty seeing it because of a glorified past. In many ways, the events in our world over the past few years have catapulted many churches and church people and church leaders in America into a simultaneous wilderness experience. A situation where all of a sudden churches and church people and church leaders were all trying to figure out what was going on all at the very same time. Everything was kind of tossed up in the air. And now 3 years later, which it's hard to believe it's been 3 years, there are still a lot of people and a lot of churches and a lot of church leaders trying to figure out what a new normal should look like. Many churches changed ministries or cut ministries or launched new ministries because of all the changes. For 3 years, I've been recording messages on YouTube. I became a televangelist, kind of, because I record and I put it online. I've been doing that for 3 years because there for a few months we weren't meeting in person, and we needed some way to still have messages going out, and so we did that for a while. It was an odd experience, and in many ways it still is a disorienting experience to look back on. When that happens, it can be easy to get stuck looking backward as if we need to get back to doing exactly what we were doing before all of that mess. Some churches were already in a wilderness experience even before all of that stuff happened with the pandemic. I think we may qualify as being in that category of still trying to figure out, make sense of where we are and where we need to be going. In the midst of trying to figure out things before everything else changed, the pre-COVID world isn't coming back. And as much as I love the 90s of my formative Christian church, which I had a little interview with Sylvia earlier where she was asking questions about my upbringing, and as I spent time preparing for that and thinking about that, there are lots of fond memories that come back about my formative years as a young person growing up. And as much as I love the 90s of my formative Christian church upbringing, those years aren't coming back. And as much as you may love particular periods of church life from other decades in your rearview mirror, they aren't coming back either. Cher may be able to turn back time, but we can't. And we can't let glorified memories from our past sow seeds of discontentment in our present and close out or cloud our ability to see what God is up to in the new normal right now. Problems in the wilderness can also emerge when there is an unhealthy fixation or preoccupation toward the future. When you're in the wilderness and you're wrestling with anxiety and uncertainty that a wilderness experience brings, the temptation is to resolve that anxiety and uncertainty as soon as possible. The temptation is to get out of that wilderness as quickly as you can and arrive at the location where there's a lot more certainty. God had given a promise and a vision of the future to Abraham, and God had given a promise and a vision of the future to Moses. The people of Israel did not want to be in the wilderness of uncertainty. They wanted to be in the promised land, but there was one big problem with that. They weren't ready. As a community, as a whole, they weren't remotely ready to reside in the land that God had promised and prepared for them. There were a few that were, but much of them weren't. And so you end up in this situation where the community is wandering in the wilderness. There was a tremendous amount of shaping that still needed to be done, and the wilderness was going to be a tool in God's toolbox to do that shaping process. For a long time, God's people had been shaped by Egypt and life in Egypt, and that was their familiar, that was their normal, that's what they had become dependent on, that's what they were used to. If God's people needed to relearn how to be completely dependent upon Him and completely faithful to Him, the desert was an ideal context for that to happen. And so you have this space where they have been separated from Egypt, but they weren't quite ready to enter the promised land. A fixation on the future and a hurry to get to a future destination can get in the way of the kind of slow and steady formation God wants to do in the lives of His people. What we would prefer instead of slow and steady is something more like those fast passes you can get at amusement parks or at Disney Park, Great America, wherever. A wristband or a badge that gives you special privileges where you can skip that long line, go right up to the front, and be one of the first people to get on that ride or whatever it happens to be. Nobody wants to be in line. Everybody wants to be on the ride. Nobody wants to be waiting. They want to be experiencing the thrill of the lifetime or, like I said, whatever it is at the end of that line they're hoping to get to the end of. A fixation on the future can be a frustrating distraction from the possibilities of the present in a wilderness of waiting. If the time spent in an hours-long line is spent entirely just looking off in the distance at where you'd much rather be, you're in for a pretty miserable and unproductive experience in that line. One of the major complaints that people continually have about amusement parks, Great America, Disney parks, whatever, is the time spent waiting in lines. They see that waiting time as wasted time. If the only purpose for being in that line is to be able to get to the other end of that destination, if that's the only thing that can happen, you're going to end up feeling like that's just a bunch of wasted time that wasn't used for anything. But it doesn't have to be that way. Waiting time doesn't have to be wasted time. Now, last year in January, when Laura and I were doing a previous vacation, I forgot about something during our packing process. all of my attention during that time when I was preparing and packing and doing all that stuff, all of my attention was on the cruise and the cruise days. What am I wearing on certain days? What do I need to bring for those certain days? And so everything was about cruise, cruise, cruise. And because my attention was on the cruise, I totally forgot to pack something, anything, for the airport or the plane ride. And because I didn't pack and prepare properly, there's things that I could have done in that space. I had lots of space, same as this time. I think last time we got to the airport at 10 o'clock and had to leave after 4 o'clock, so we had an even longer wait last time. I could have brought something to do in that space. I could have brought a book or two to read, could have brought some things to journal or write, but because I didn't pack and prepare properly, that long wait at the airport last time was a miserable waste of time. This most recent trip was different, though. Instead of a complete fixation on the future destination and the cruise, I paid attention to the journey. There were cheaper snacks that I could buy and stuff into my bag that I could take through security that would save me a lot of money on snack goodies. There were books that I could bring that I did bring this time that I had ready to go, and they were ready to be read. So that way, my time waiting in the airport could be used in better ways. One book that I'm currently reading is titled How to Lead When You Don't Know Where You're Going, Leading in a Liminal Season. This is a book that I got started reading before the cruise, and it actually talked a little bit about airports. So I'm like, I'm going to bring this, I'm going to read this while I'm in an airport. A liminal season is a season between where you've been and where you're going. It's the threshold where you are in between. A threshold where you're neither here nor there. It's a pretty precarious place to be in because there's the possibility in that space for either unproductive anxiety or constructive creativity, depending on how you approach that in-between season. By being mindful of the fact that I would have a season of waiting before arriving at the cruise ship and a season of waiting on the way back, I was prepared for the in-between space and made better use of that time than I did the previous time. A preoccupation with the future can get in the way of what we should be doing today. In uncertain times, it's natural to be drawn toward people, personalities, and voices that exude confidence and certainty. When people want to get out of an anxious situation, the bold and confident voice of someone declaring that they know the way forward, they know the way through, they know the way out of the wilderness, they know how to get you where you'd much rather be, they have some sort of a fast pass to get you to your desired destination, that voice is an appealing voice. It can be a calming voice, it can be a reassuring voice, and it can be a fleeting voice. It's tempting to believe that the role and responsibility of a good leader, great leader, is to be that bold and confident voice who has a very clear plan because they were given very clear directives directly from the mouth of God, as if they spent the week on the mountaintop covered in smoke where it was just the pastor and God, and now they have writing on the tablets to show for their conversation. While that may be nice, that's not exactly how things work. God didn't write these on a mountaintop. These didn't get written in that way. When it comes to the future plans we see given to people like Moses and Abraham, I don't think it's helpful if we superimpose their experiences onto the lives of every leader, as if the experiences of Moses and Abraham were just super common experiences that all leaders and all pastors should commonly expect to happen as a part of their leadership opportunity. When I share on a Sunday morning what I've been thinking through and what I've put together, I don't want anyone ever thinking in some way that I wrote exactly, directly, what God told me to say. To be honest, I don't know if that's ever been the case, even in hundreds and hundreds of sermons. What I can say is that for each and every sermon along the way, including this one, my prayer has always been for God to just take what I have and use it and offer it up. Here's what I have. Here is my attempt to be faithful to do what you've asked me to do. I'm not Moses, I'm not Abraham, and neither are the pastors and leaders out there who like to present themselves as being like Moses or Abraham in order to lead people in the direction they feel like people need to go. While those of you here might hope for or prefer a situation where Pastor Ryan has received divinely communicated plans with just step-by-step directions to guide Calvary out of a wilderness and into a promised land of revival, God has not given me that sort of thing, and it is not for a lack of asking. Chances are that I have just as many, if not more, uncertainties than anyone else here might have. You'd think I'd have a lot more certainties than others, but I don't think I do. There's very little that I'm certain about. But with that being said, there are a few things I am absolutely certain about. God is good, God will provide, and God asks us to be faithful. I'm not certain of much else beyond that, but God is good today, God will provide for us today, and God asks for us to be faithful today. But what's the plan? What are we supposed to do next week, next month, next year? What about our tomorrows? In the words of Jesus, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. The wilderness season is a season where today needs to get the attention and the focus that it deserves. We can't spend our todays looking back at a glorified past or spend our todays trying to hurry toward the future where we're not really actually shaped and prepared for yet. There is tremendous value in the season of waiting because there's a lot of work that God wants to do in and through his people in the wilderness, in their liminal season of waiting. And next week, we're going to look at a couple different things that we need to help us during the seasons of waiting in the wilderness. But for right now, what we need is for God to get our attention where it needs to be today. If you're in a wilderness, you can't go back to the glory days and you can't transport yourself to the promised land. So what are you going to do with today? May God open our eyes to see clearly what God is up to in our present. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing to you, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. This morning, we're going to be closing with the song, Open My Eyes That I May See. And perhaps you already know this, but we live in a world filled with distractions. Sometimes you need to just get away and separate yourself from all of the busyness and all of the noise so you can be able to see and hear clearly. Kind of like how you need to get away from the city lights in order to see the stars. You need to get some space from the city with all the lights and all the things that fill the sky. You need to get away from that so you can be alone and be able to have the space you need to look up and see the stars more clearly. Long ago, there were Christian monastic type people who went to great lengths to get away from the world so they could have a rhythm for their lives that made it easier for them to see what God wanted them to see, to hear what God wanted them to hear, and to do what God wanted them to do. In the Exodus, God's people found themselves in a situation that seemed very far from ideal, but it was exactly what they needed, and God used it to help them see and hear him much better. My hope is that this season in our lives, this season of Lent, would be an opportunity for us personally and corporately for us to make our way toward Easter in a way where we can see and hear God better than maybe we have in the past. So go ahead and stand this morning as the song we're going to sing is about opening our eyes. We need to be able to see clearly what God's doing in our midst, in our present.